This is the BBC.
Thanks for downloading Analysis. You might be listening to this podcast on a smartphone or device. Should we be worried about the effect of screens and social media on the mental health of teenage children? David Baker investigates.
The problem with smartphones is that they suck you in. Smartphones, they're infinitely deep. It's a very deep rabbit hole.
This is the voice of someone who's concerned about technology. And the funny thing is, he invented it.
My name is Lauren Brichter. I'm an ex-employee of Apple and Twitter. I didn't realize that there were these downsides until a few years after I'd stopped working for Twitter. The addictiveness of it.
Former Silicon Valley executives like Lauren are becoming more vocal. Stepping back from the techno-optimism of the new digital age, they've started to sound an alarm about what they've invented, and especially about that hugely powerful piece of kit we carry around in our pockets, the smartphone, and what it's doing to our kids.
I still have cousins who are in high school. You know, they're hooked on them. I don't like it.
I'm David Baker, and I've spent a lot of my career reporting on the effect of technology on human beings. And in this edition of Analysis, I'm going to be looking at the increasingly loud calls to do something about the way technology is, apparently, damaging a whole generation. It's a powerful argument, and there are some big names behind it. But beneath the noise, what's the evidence behind these claims? And what, if anything, should we do to protect our kids?
So you hear my two kids, Leo is 4 and Zephyr has just turned 2. They're currently building some very elaborate magnet structures.
Lauren is a long way from Silicon Valley now, building a house for himself and his family in New Jersey, where the children play with actual toys. But a part of him is present in the life of anyone who uses a smartphone today. In 2008, in the heyday of the lone tech developer, he developed an app for Twitter.
So in this app, there was this thing called pull to refresh. So when you would scroll to the top of the list and you would pull down a little bit more, your list would automatically refresh. You didn't have to tap a button. It was sort of a neat feature at the time.
Pulling down the screen, letting it spring back, is now pretty universal on smartphone apps. And doesn't it feel fun when we do it? And back then, it felt a wonderfully natural way to find out if we had any new tweets or notifications or whatever. But now, Lauren isn't so sure.
Oh, man. When I invented it, I did not build it to be an addicting thing. I built it as just a novel user interface mechanism. And it's being used in a way that I think is damaging, which makes me sad.
And he's very worried, he says, about his kids getting sucked into the digital world he helped create, becoming addicted to their phones and lacking, as he puts it, original thoughts.
When they grow up, unless something dramatic changes with the way smartphones work, I'm going to resist letting them have them for, I think, a really long time.
How long is a really long time?
I mean, maybe even through high school.
That's your wife calling it. It's impossible to keep them off smartphones until the end of high school.
I know it might be impossible, but there might be ways to lock it down, at least lock down some of the social features.
This movement against the smartphone is being led by a vocal coalition of academics and ex-Silicon Valley types like Lauren, who are now worried about what they see as the dangers of the digital world. Like the phone itself, it started in the US, but it's growing here too. The argument tends to swing between whether the harm is caused by social media, or the amount of time teenagers spend looking at their screens, or something else like the way people communicate online. But in the end, the object of their worry is that blue glow around a young person's face as they sit looking at their phone completely absorbed in another world. Their fears got a big boost last year with the publication of a book called iGen by Gene Twenge, a professor of psychology at San Diego State University. In it, and in many articles and interviews around it, Twenge made a powerful claim.
iGen is the generation born after 1995. They are the first generation to spend their entire adolescence with smartphones, and that's had ripple effects across many areas of their lives. And around 2012, I started to notice some rather sudden and large changes. Looking at these very large, nationally representative surveys of teens and young adults done here in the States. Teens more likely to say that they felt useless, that they felt like they couldn't do anything right. They felt lonely. And these are classic symptoms of depression. And then I started to see these similar trends for major depression, suicide, self-harm, like cutting and taking too many pills.
So what do you think we can ascribe this jump in symptoms, jump in depression to?
2011, 2012, that happens to be the time that smartphones became common. The percentage of Americans who owned a smartphone crossed 50%, so the timing lines up almost perfectly.
Twenge's claims have caused a sensation on both sides of the Atlantic. Here in Britain, the stats are slightly different, but we have seen a small but significant rise in reported anxiety amongst teenage girls, and there's been a sharp rise of admissions to hospital due to self-harm. If Twenge is right, we really have invented a monster. Smartphones are not just annoying, they're actually dangerous. And the book is full of graphs and data that seem to bear this out. But are her claims valid?
Percentages and data are something that our society runs on at the moment. You know, everybody likes saying, oh, there's been a study that showed this, oh, the data shows this. But data isn't as hard and as all or nothing as we often feel like it is. Data can be construed in certain ways.
Amy Aubin is a researcher at the Department of Experimental Psychology at the University of Oxford. And at 23, she's part of the generation Twenge's worried about. Aubin's currently working on a review of all the evidence that we have about smartphone use and mental health, and she doesn't want to second-guess her conclusions. But she's convinced that Twenge's data doesn't back up the argument that smartphones are harming our kids.
If we focus on the link between social media use and depressive symptoms, we find that there are significant correlations, but there's two things we need to remember. So on the one hand, as probably Radio 4 listeners hear so many times, correlation is not causation, so we can't say that because two things are linked, one causes the other. And then if we actually look at that correlation, we see that correlation is actually quite small.
In fact, very small. According to Amy Aubin, just 0.36% of girls' symptoms of depression can be explained by their smartphone use. The problem for those of us who are not statisticians is that these graphs feel convincing. And without the context, it's hard to judge what is a significant difference. One person's blip can be another's vertiginous rise. Andy Shabilsky, Amy Aubin's colleague and a senior researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute, says it's helpful to put data in context. He's been researching the link between teenage well-being and different kinds of screen time for a long time now, and has found that at very high levels, 6, 7, 8 hours a day, there does seem to be a negative effect. But
this negative effect was about a third the size of missing breakfast.
Jean Twenge, however, prefers to err on the side of caution.
So what are the downsides in giving advice of limit your use of electronic devices to less than 2 hours a day? Not a whole lot, especially because we're talking about leisure time here. We're not talking about work or homework time. But what's the downside to doing nothing? Even if there's a chance that spending an excessive amount of time on screens might play a role in the increased levels of self-harm and anxiety and suicide, that's a big downside. To wait, sit on your hands, and do nothing while teens are suffering, that's not a chance I'm willing to take.
And a lot of people seem to agree with her. Worrying stories about smartphones seem to be everywhere at the moment. I'm looking online here at a number of news sites, and it's easy to find dramatic warnings about how the digital world is harming our kids. Here's one: mobile phone addiction, it's time to take back control. That's from The Guardian. There's another one here: for students, less kindness for strangers, from The New York Times, about a drop in empathy amongst millennials. And how about this? Instagram, worst social media app for young people's mental health, on CNN. And if I scroll down, I can see that that one is backed up by a report from a big UK charity. And even more powerfully, many of these stories reference impressive-sounding academic papers to make their point. If the press is to be believed, we really are facing a smartphone apocalypse. But you know what? I've also got here a pile of those academic papers, and none of them claim to have found a causal link between smartphone use and anxiety or depression or whatever. They just don't make that firm connection. It really feels there's a lot of misreporting, or at least oversimplification of the argument. Take that word addiction, for instance.
I think now that we use the word addiction quite a lot colloquially, we're kind of blurring the boundaries between, you know, some kind of casual use of the word and what it actually means in psychology. And I think these phrases like, oh, you get a dopamine kick and it makes you addicted.
Yeah, so for instance, learning a great new science fact on Radio 4 will give you a hit of dopamine. The question is, what context can we put that in with respect to doing an illegal substance? And screens and learning and these things, they're all clustered around each other in terms of the amount of free-floating dopamine that's associated with the task. But that's less than 1/10 or 1/50 of what happens when somebody does a line of cocaine.
Maybe all this drama is just how we've always reacted to new inventions. Andy Shabilsky says he can understand people's fear of new technology, but says it seldom turned out to be justified.
So I think starting about 40 years ago, the panic around video games started. There was a game called Death Race in 1976. And when this video game was released, there was a call from popular psychologists to ban it because it involved running over gremlins. And people were quite worried that this would lead to dangerous driving.
That was in the US, but there was a similar outcry in 1997 here in the UK over a game called Carmageddon, where humans rather than gremlins were the target. Perhaps inevitably, it caught the unforgiving eye of the BBC's Jeremy Paxman.
Carmageddon is the gift for the child who has everything except a sense of social responsibility. It sells itself on the understated subtitle, It's Murder on the Streets.
These fears and many others haven't materialized. There was a moral panic around Dungeons and Dragons leading to Satanism, rap music leading to a rise in urban crime. And we really find that year on year and decade on decade, with some exceptions, young people are more healthy. They drink less, they smoke less, there are fewer teenage pregnancies. And so really, despite all of these fears, the kids of today are really all right.
Of course, that might be because they're spending more time on their phone. But whatever the reason, there does seem to be something in the air about smartphone use. I certainly feel pretty uncomfortable when I see groups of teenagers walking down the street staring at their phones, or families in restaurants tapping away and ignoring each other. That might be because I'm just the wrong generation. I can, just about, remember black and white TV. Something that Douglas Adams, author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and a sharp observer of humans and technology, identified in what he called his three rules of innovation.
Rule one, anything that's in the world when you're born is normal and ordinary and just a natural part of the way the world works. Rule two, anything that's invented between when you're 15 and 35 is new and exciting and revolutionary and you can probably get a career in it. Rule three, anything that's invented after you're 35 is against the natural order of things.
But others feel there is something different this time round, something about the technology itself.
I'm Sonia Livingstone. I'm a professor at the Department of Media and Communications in the London School of Economics. I've been researching the way in which children have engaged with, quote, new media for about 20 years, since the days of the VCR and the first arrival of the home computer and so on. Now, we've created a device that converges all the different technologies we've ever had, and we've put them all in this one small object. It's, you know, how children engage in the world, how they literally find out the bus time to school or stay in touch with their grandmother, and it embeds so many different kind of legal and technological layers within it that just managing it is demanding.
Now, that debate about how to manage the smartphone is quite vibrant at the moment, to say the least. What's your feeling about, if you like, the quality of the argument that's going on at the moment?
I guess I'm concerned that all the difficulties that children are facing in the world are somehow getting attached to the smartphone, and it's distracting us in a way from uncertainties about education, competitiveness about getting ahead, uncertainties about changing traditions of family and community life. There are lots of reasons for anxiety, but we are all looking at the phone as if that's the problem, and if we deal with the phone, we'll have made children's lives better magically.
So maybe there is a cost of acting too soon, on too little evidence. We could be missing other reasons why girls especially seem to be suffering from increased anxiety and depression. And it could be that focusing on something like screen time distracts us from other dangers that the digital world presents. Andy Shabilsky.
There are a lot of potentially really scary things going on with technology and young people. Never before have children been, say, recorded throughout all of their childhood by devices that don't necessarily have good protections. There are no regulatory frameworks around smart toys, new apps that kind of are Ubers for babysitting that don't have Ofsted approval. And so there's kind of a lot of places that our attention is drawn away when we talk about screens. And I'm really hoping that we can make some space for that debate.
This is a heady argument and it can get heated. So let's leave the academics battling it out and move on. What does an actual teenager think?
So it's about 7:15 and I'm just using my phone to check when my bus is coming.
It's 7:45. I'm just using my phone to talk to my friends.
It's after school. I'm on my way home. I'm going to listen to some music and probably just check Instagram for a bit.
Meet Stella. She's 15, a Londoner, and an avid phone user.
I'm midway through my homework and I'm just going to have a break and go on my phone for a bit because it's just really long and hard.
I went to see her at home with her mum, Natalie, to find out how she manages her relationship with her phone.
Do you want a cup of tea?
I'd love one, please. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
And it turns out she's a lot more mature about it than a lot of adults I can think of. She has separate private and public accounts on Instagram. She understands the nuances of online communication. And she sometimes puts her phone away completely.
Sometimes I just, when everything's getting really overwhelmed, I'll just be like, you know what, I'm not going to use it the whole weekend.
And she's also kept a really close eye on how her phone use affects her well-being.
I used to be on my phone before going to bed and it did mean that my sleeping pattern got really bad. It took me really long to go to sleep, and now I have to have sleep meditation.
What were you doing on it at that time of night?
Just talking to my friends, because, of course, it is the time where everyone goes on their phone, so it means everyone's there, and then that makes it really hard to stop, to, like, put your phone down and go to sleep.
Because that's rather like leaving a party, which is going on quite well. You know, no one really wants to leave a party when it's going in flow like that.
Yeah, it's exactly like that.
It does remind me, though, I remember when Stella was very little. For Christmas, somebody had bought her a doll that would cry. Do you remember?
Yeah.
And I remember Stella had two sleepless nights with a doll that wouldn't go to sleep. Something that I think that is difficult, more difficult for Stella's generation than for mine, is that you can't compartmentalise your life so easily. So if I was having a horrible time at school, and I think probably most people have horrible times at school at one time or another, I would come home and then that would be it. I could leave school at school and I could be a different person at home. And I think it is difficult to be on all the time.
This seems to be a common effect of social media. It blurs our boundaries, mixing school and home, public and private. Laverne Antrobus is a child psychologist at the Tavistock Clinic in North London.
I think that what social media does is it sort of attaches itself to problems or difficulties. So, you know, children have a sense of themselves and their own potency in terms of academia, and then they might feel that they see lots of posts of friends online who don't seem to be doing lots of work. You know, they're posting all the time, but they're getting top marks. So I think it has that sort of rather adhesive quality to some of the big hitting issues that we see in the clinic.
This chimes with something that Stella told me. The online world can sometimes act like an echo chamber where things feel worse.
I think it is an outlet for people, and then that can intensify what they're feeling a lot and take it out of control. It will make them physically upset and, like, crying and stuff. And also there is, like, a bad side, especially on Instagram, I think. So there's a lot of self-harm accounts or anorexia accounts that are really easily accessible for everyone, and it is really bad.
So we might not have hard evidence from the academics, but anecdotally, at least, smartphones and the world they give access to do seem to have the potential to cause kids a lot of problems. They can amplify feelings of loneliness and anxiety. They can open their eyes to things we'd rather they didn't see. And they can certainly cause sleeplessness. The question is this anecdotal evidence enough to act upon?
I've been quite sort of curious about this dilemma because it's one of the thoughts I have that actually in my head I feel quite worried about social media, but actually I'm not sure I've got the evidence in front of me to support some of the alarm.
Laverne Antrobus, child psychologist at the Tavistock Clinic.
But I think the alarm is real. I mean, the alarm is real because, you know, I'm out in a social world where, you know, I drive in, I see children, adults on their phones. I see none of the orderliness of the interactions that, you know, perhaps rather fancifully, I think I had when I was waiting at the bus stop. You know, that sort of social contact seems to be being replaced by contact with a phone. We have a good antennae, actually, for just thinking, what if? Or should we just be a little bit careful?
So, what do we do? Well, we could just sit tight and wait for more data to become available. But parents are worried now and are being bombarded with suggestions for things we could do in the meantime. Sonia Livingston at the LSE has been on a number of government committees looking into how we might manage the way the digital world affects our children. I've got some here, actually, some recommendations. I just wonder if I could read some of them out to you and just see briefly what you think of them. So this is from a very typical article. Ban smartphones for kids. They should never have unsupervised access to the internet.
I think there are so many reasons why smartphones get used that banning is the wrong word. But we haven't said anything about children's age and maturity, and we should really recognise it's not that a two-year-old needs their own smartphone. We've designed a society in which a 14 or 15-year-old probably does need their own smartphone if they're to be included. Somewhere in between, and that's the whole of childhood, is the negotiation. So what we know from research on family life is banning is a very crude technique that leads people to try to evade it. And anyway, it damages the relationship between parent and child or indeed between teacher and child.
OK, here's another one here. Require all smartphone makers to show regular mental health warnings prominently on the screens after a certain amount of usage.
I think there is more that smartphone designers and manufacturers could do. So I don't think panicky messages that say, you know, you're going to go square-eyed or you're going to go crazy if you spend any time, but perhaps occasionally pop-ups. Did you realise you've been on this for 2 hours, or do you need to get up out of your chair and move around? I think a little bit of that could work.
And maybe the issue is wider than just the apps. Lauren Brichter, the Silicon Valley refusenik who we met at the beginning of the programme, feels the problem lies with the economics of the technology industry as a whole, where eyeballs on screens generate advertising revenue.
As long as the incentives and the profit motives are aligned in a certain way, certain things are going to happen. I don't know, part of me is curious what would happen if, like, let's say overnight you just banned advertising, you know, Google and Facebook. What would the profit motive now be for them?
And they'd be replaced maybe with a subscription service. We'd just pay maybe an annual fee to use Google or an annual fee to use Facebook or Gmail.
Maybe.
And what about government itself? Could regulation help here? Sonia Livingston points to a new data protection bill that comes into force in May, which will make internet companies think harder about the potential harm they cause.
And is that including the risk to kids of using their smartphones too late at night, for example?
It should. We will need some good hard evidence that the harm is really there if we're going to make that count in the kind of legal cases that would, you know, be needed to ensure compliance. But yes.
Enforcement, regulation, that all sounds really wonderful and important when it comes to harm, especially when it comes to our kids. But really, you know, if we find actually it's harmful for children to be up late using their smartphones at 2 o'clock in the morning, who do we blame for that? Do we blame the smartphone manufacturer? Do we blame WhatsApp? Do we blame Facebook? Where can we even lay the blame to begin with, or the responsibility?
Of course, as you imply, parents have a key responsibility. And so do the communities that parents are part of. So parents say they feel under enormous pressure because everyone else has got a smartphone or everyone else is talking late at night. So this is where I think social norms become important. At the moment, each parent feels under siege. We need to start, and I think we are beginning to develop some social norms that will support parents in the decisions they need to make about when to say no to their children.
In the end, it'll be culture, not so much as regulation, that will save us from this.
It's going to be both, because regulation sends a really powerful message to the culture, and the culture sets the terms in which the regulation is clearly needed.
But where are social norms actually worked out? Well, it's in the bedrooms and kitchens of teenagers and their parents. In the US, a group of concerned mothers has already got together to set some guidelines of their own.
So our idea was to really link arms and support one another in this and just hold off until at least eighth grade before we give our children smartphones.
6,200 families have signed the pledge.
The pledge is...
Eighth grade, that's 12 and 13-year-olds. But that working out can also take place just on a one-on-one level. Remember Stella and her sleepless nights?
So what did you do to change that?
Well, now my parents take my phone or I just leave it downstairs to charge at about 8:30, I'd say.
And is this a kind of house rule here now that there's no phones after 8 o'clock?
Yeah.
Maybe, while we wait for more data, this is the way to tackle the challenge of smartphones. Working things out by trial and error. Using our instincts for what works and what doesn't. And in fact, since I met Stella and Natalie, I've come across quite a lot of people who lock their phones in drawers at night.
Does that apply to your mum's phone?
No, not at
no?
all.
No? Natalie, why doesn't that apply to your phone?
Because I'm a grown-up.
Also, mum doesn't have to wake up till about 10, 11.
That's not true. But I think there is a difference because I am a grown-up. And I think a 15-year-old should not be expected to have entirely responsibility for their own behaviour. I wouldn't send Stella to bed with, you know, 42 packets of WhatsApps and say, see how you go with that. So I think it's the same with phone use.
So, what have we learnt? Well, the jury is still out on exactly what the link is, if any, between smartphone use and those reported increases in anxiety and depression amongst teenagers, both here and in the US. And that's not surprising. Smartphones were only invented 10 years ago. But there does seem to be anecdotal evidence that smartphones and social media, if they aren't directly causing depression amongst teenagers, are at least exacerbating it. And phones are definitely keeping a lot of our kids awake at night. Sonia Livingston would like government to get involved, maybe setting up a one-stop shop where parents can find the latest data and advice about smartphone use. But in the meantime, it feels like it's up to parents and teenagers to work it out themselves, just like Natalie and Stella have done. And maybe that's no bad thing, because it leaves room for instinct, for common sense, things that we humans are actually pretty good at. Smartphones are somehow both fascinating and terrifying at the same time. But in the end, we'll work out how to integrate them into our lives, just like we've done with all the other tools we've invented. And by then, of course, there'll be another new technology causing concern. And it'll be today's teenagers leading the calls to contain it.
Analysis was presented by David Baker and produced by Lucy Proctor. In the next episode, Jonathan Marcus looks at new challenges to the global system of arms control. We always love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at @BBC_analysis and on Facebook at @BBC_Radio4Analysis.